Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with stage and screen actor Billy Crudup. When I first met Billy 15 years ago, I knew I was witnessing a defining moment in his career. After all, I was assigned to photograph him for an Esquire cover story titled The Next Big Thing. What I didn't fully realize back then was how conflicted he was about that title. The movie Almost Famous had just put him in line to be Hollywood's new leading man, but his gut was telling him to step out of the queue. I think he made the right decision, and the proof is in films like Without Limits, Rudderless, Spotlight, and Stage Beauty, and plays like The Elephant Man and Arcadia. His story about that play in particular will tell you everything you need to know about what kind of actor he is. But I'll spoil the surprise if I go any further. Suffice to say, he's the kind who does it for exactly the right reasons. Billy is honest and self-deprecating to a fault, not to mention a pretty funny guy. He shares some of the most inspiring and humbling moments of his career, his approach to playing real versus fictional characters, and the roles that tested him most. He also talks about faking it, on and off camera, and why failing doesn't matter as long as you're reaching for something. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Billy.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
You know, I was very excited to have you on, and I've asked you since I started the show. We have an existing friendship and known you for many years. But, God, going back and looking at all your films again, so many of which I saw when they came out but hadn't seen since, like, it was really fun. So it's great to see you and be reminded of the work you've done through this process.
I'm incredibly flattered to the point of being almost speechless.
That I watched your films?
That you watched my films. And that also I've been around long enough to have had a bunch of movies to see that worth seeing.
And you know, we should say how we met, because I photographed you for the cover of Esquire magazine when Almost Famous hadn't come out yet. So this
was a
long time ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you knew this, but from my end, you know, there was a lot of pressure from the magazine of, this guy's the guy, he's the next big thing, you know, that it had,
and little did you know,
to be good.
You had a petulant asshole on the other side who had heard a version of that, but only in like whispers and murmurs, and I was just not having any of it. I was like, dude, I'm an actor. I went into debt learning to be an actor. That was the part that I was not prepared for. Nobody tells you if you're really successful at this, people are gonna dig through your garbage.
Right.
Like that. And
right.
So all of that is part of the same kind of system. Is like doing a magazine cover makes you exposed in a different way, giving people access to your own story as a way to sell tickets, sell your own career, all of those things. It just seemed anathema to me to what I was trying to do, which is pretend to be other people,
right,
to tell stories. You
right.
know, like the last thing I wanted to do was show some kind of version of myself or create some kind of character who was a movie star. You
know? The funny thing about that is you're probably the only person that I know that would complain about that, but that's exactly why I like you. I think that you're absolutely right. Like
the pressure for me was, if I don't make a photo that meets their expectations, yeah. then I won't get hired again.
Right,
either.
Exactly. And it takes a long time to get to that like easy way of relating, because the truth is, in that moment, I didn't know what a photo shoot was. I didn't really know what my publicist did. I still don't know what you do, Simon Halls. Why I pay you is beyond me. Well, I guess for moments like this, it's worth it to,
That's
to
right.
be at moments
it's
like this.
It's very hard to get on this show.
But I didn't know what anybody did. What I did know how to do is, if somebody gave me a screenplay or a play, I could rehearse it, I could think about it, I could ask questions, and then I could probably perform it okay enough to get another job, and occasionally do something that I didn't even think I could do. But what I didn't know how to do was manage this side of it, which was about self-promotion, creating an identity for people to be invested in, and also to ride the wave of potential, you
right.
know? And that part was super weird to me, because for sure, if you look around, the careers of the people who are the hot shit at one point, it's not like a steady rise.
Right.
It's just this and this. And I was looking for a long career. I started to go like this, and then I realized I started to kind of go like this. I was looking for a mound of a career. So my plans were interfered with by potential. You know?
Well, when the magazine comes out and it says the next big thing.
Yeah, right.
I would think that could only be bad, because either you are, and it's really a one in a million thing, that whatever that means, or you don't live up to it.
Did you have that experience when you were like, taking photographs?
I've never been on the cover of a magazine where it said the next big thing. No.
But for sure, like when your photographs came out and people were like, oh no, we need this guy for this job. And you were like, that job? I don't know if I'm quite ready for that job.
Yes. And I think anyone who's been in a creative place where they found some success, they usually found it too young to handle it.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely how I felt. And I know tons of actors. I went to school with some phenomenal actors. I have had more good fortune, great parts, incredible opportunities, been able to get paid than the vast majority of them. And yet still there are times when I have to have interviews with people where they're like, you almost made it big. You know,
isn't
like,
that funny?
And
because of that expectation that
and
at
it's
some
because
point
of the
in your
expectation,
career,
exactly.
It's Simon
and
Hall's
in fact,
fault.
Because the name of my most successful movie is Almost Famous, people think they're being super smart every time. Just so you know, everybody has said that to me, okay? I don't know which camera to look in there. I'm going to look right down the middle.
That's why you're almost famous, because you don't know which camera to look into.
Exactly. There's a million reasons why I'm almost famous. But you make me feel very famous being here.
Well, listen, by looking at your whole career, I think that you managed to always go after projects with people who are reaching for something.
Thanks, dude.
And Almost Famous is a great example of that. And it's one of those films that, you know, like my favorite records, they were not in the top of the charts in the first week. They became masterpieces after 10 years of people
right.
finding them.
Oh, definitely. It is so much more popular now than it was then. And it was, you know...
And it holds up.
Does it? I haven't seen it actually in a while. But I know I have... that younger people are seeing it because... because they'll do a double take, you know, of me at the airport and be kind of like, is that, ooh, that might be Russell's dad. I know they've just seen the movie for the first time, and I have to tell them that it's fine. It was, you know, 17 years ago, and something happens in life where you age, and it's going to happen to you too.
That's right.
And so just try to be kind to your elders.
Well, in the film, you're being pursued by Patrick Fugit's character, who is playing basically a young Cameron Crowe, and all he wants to do is get his interview with the elusive guitar-slinging Russell Hammond, who's sort of like a Jimmy Page-esque type of guy. And at the end, you realize what Cameron really wanted, what anyone really wants in that moment, is to really understand what it feels like to be in that thin air of creativity, right? And so when he says, what do you really love about music? And you pick up your chair and you turn it around and you sit down and the camera pulls back and you see the whole room and you go, okay, now he's doing what we've all wanted the whole movie, which is he's going to let us inside his heart and he's going to tell us why, in this cynical, mixed up world of music, he really loves what he does. And I think that's the thing that draws me to this career, to movies, to records, to books, like what it is that makes people get excited about art. I mean, it's funny, it's almost like I want to lean forward with all my 16-year-old earnestness and say, what do you love about acting?
You made me think about a million different things there. And it's moving to me, you know, to hear it being effective to people and to artists. And like what Cameron was after was more sophisticated than I even understood at that moment. Like about the artistic engine and why we follow that. And I think if you put yourself in situations where you're with people who are more ambitious than you, that are more talented than you, that have their own creative engines, you can exceed your own expectations in creative expression. And when that happens, it's a vivid kind of living. Like the world is on fire. You know, I've had moments on stage where every second seems to last forever because you're so hyper aware of being the agent of some kind of creative expression that people are receiving. So all you really want in each of those scenarios of artistic expression is to have a dialogue with the people who are witnessing it about what it means to be alive and what it means to be alive from the inside of your body and your mind. And you want to commune with people, you know. And so when that connection happens, you get lit up, and it's such a rare experience that you feel privileged doing it. You know, you feel not many people in the world get to experience that. And to do it consciously and to have the ability to be aware when it's happening and it's like winning the lottery, man. You know.
Do you remember the first time you felt that?
I do. It was really, for me, the first preview of a Tom Stoppard play called Arcadia. I had never been on Broadway before. The material was super sophisticated. I mean, the part was like a dream part. I got to be, my first part on Broadway, I got to be this incredibly smart, sexy, witty tutor to a genius girl who ends up dying saving her. It's just like heroic, you know, and all you want to do is not fuck it up. And so that pressure, that's something you have to manage early on. And the way that you do it is you go back to your, like the workman part of the work that you understand. I remember our rehearsals. I understand how to be present in this moment. I'm going to breathe. I'm going to use my voice, all of those things. But those are only to get you to the point of that potential of connecting to people. And you never know if you're going to be prepared when it actually happens. When you get the opportunity, sometimes you just don't have it. Sometimes people freeze. And I remember the curtain went up and Jennifer Dundas, who was playing the young girl who I tutored, said, "Septimus, what is carnal embrace?" And my line was, "Carnal embrace is the practice of throwing one's arms around a side of beef." Because she's a precocious 13-year-old girl and I don't want to tell her about sex. And the audience falls out. And I can remember this wave of relief and thrill. And I felt like I knew exactly what to do and that I was in exactly the right place. This wow. is where I belonged. And I didn't expect to have that feeling. I mean, it's incredible. I haven't thought about that in forever, but I'm sure I didn't sleep much that night. You know, the rush that you get from being lit up like that is, it's rare, you know.
Right.
And that's one of the great things about artistry is sometimes, you know, and people call it the muse or whatever that thing is. Now, to me, it's being lit up. Like you're the part of your brain that, you know, thinks about things logically, turns off.
Well, it's a precarious thing though, right? Because what if you'd walked out and she screws up her first line, and then your line falls flat. I wonder how much that first experience is, like the fact that that first experience was so good.
Well, you said something to me that actually was incredibly meaningful, and I took as like the greatest compliment. You said it looked like the people that you were with were after something, and that has been for sure part of my plan. I can't write anything. I remember having this discussion with Matt Damon when we were at the wedding.
Yeah, right.
And I was saying, listen, man, I'm at a point right now where I don't know how to get any artistic agency because I'm not getting parts the way that I did before. And I don't even know what to do with myself as an actor. I don't know what my best version of myself is. And he goes, well, why don't you write something? And I'm like, easy for you to fucking say, dude. The first thing you wrote got an Academy Award. Yeah, yeah, suck it. Have you seen my writing? It's terrible. Look at me. It's Billy Crudup here, okay? I can't write anything, dude. But when you depend upon other people to be the primary instrument in your creative expression, that is to say, they write the screenplay or they have the idea for the story or they write the play and somebody else is going to direct it. They have the vision about how that story is going to be communicated in this medium. The best I can do is just be an instrument in the orchestra. That's like my best version. And so the way for me to be the most potentially rad at doing that is by associating myself with people who are much smarter than me, who have a proven track record, and who are after something. So part of being a professional is knowing how to manage those and knowing how to let go that of this desire to hold on to whatever that magical moment was, you know, and like, or to get back to it. I want to look back on my career and think at least everything I tried, even if it was, or not everything, most of the things that I tried to do had the intention of being rad in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in a privileged position because we know a lot of people who are, you know, extremely successful, but if you named every actor you've ever heard of, you'd probably be naming 0.5% of the Screen Actors Guild. And those are the people who actually get paychecks this year. You know, that this is the rare, these are the CEOs that, you know, they're not like the actors.
Right, right, right.
So I thought, man, if I am in such a privileged position, I better do everything I can to take advantage of that. And I don't have a high cost of living, so I'm not in pursuit of, you know, money and planes, and that would be great to have a plane. If anyone wants to give me a lot of money to get I will do it.
We give a plane to every guest that comes on.
I'll be damned. I knew this was going to be a win-win situation. I got to talk about myself and I get a plane. But the I thought the best thing I can do, the most responsible version of me would be to just have that intention every time, or like I say, almost every time.
Well, it shows, and I want to bring up something that I didn't know until I started reading, which is you didn't initially get Arcadia. And you, on your own, kept working on the role. And to me, that says the end result wasn't to get the job alone. The end result was to get the part and to really know he had the part. Like, can you explain when you heard you didn't get that role, what your mindset was?
I mean, that's an awesome question, and I'm aware of the fact that it paints me in a very favorable light, so I'll try to give as realistic an answer as I can. I reference school a lot because in the 3 years that I was there, I don't think I've ever been through an expansion of my own understanding of myself and my own understanding of this craft as I could have possibly imagined.
That happened in school.
That happened in school. So what it ignited for me was the potential of learning all the time, the potential of discovery. And this is what I was talking about before, about like exceeding your own expectations of yourself or exceeding your own potential. Once you realize that that is possible in a collaborative environment, that you can actually, you know, steal from people, you can observe somebody's process and be inspired by it, you can incorporate it into your own and do things that you didn't know that you could do before. Once you get into that mindset, it's really, you become fixated on it. You look for every opportunity where you can do that. But this was a particular moment where I got this material, and Tom Stoppard's words are fucking impenetrable. Like, you know, everything is a double and triple entendre, and like, he's interested. I mean, Arcady is about landscape gardening and chaos mathematics. Okay, I'm just trying to keep, you know, like my pants on, you know, make sure my fly is up. Like this is way out of my framework. I don't sit at home and read science magazines going, oh, that's your thought on the space-time continuum? No, sir. But so I got this material and I had an idea of who this character was supposed to be, but it was like very generalized. Right. And accents for me, I have to work on. I have to go to, like, roll up my sleeves, go to work. You go word by word, you break down the sounds, you try to understand it phonetically. Then you listen to a lot of tapes of people to get the melody of a certain part of the world or a dialect. You know, it's just, it's hard work. You know, it's just like becoming flexible in a new way. So I can't just get something where the guy's British and go, oh, well, I certainly know how to do that. Which accent would you like? Well, I'm kind of doing it right now. I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, actually,
wow, that
you're pretty good.
That wasn't too bad. But
Mine all sound like Apu from The Simpsons, no matter what country it's from.
I'm pretty sure most of mine sounds Jamaican. No matter what I'm doing, it sounds Jamaican. But in any case, so I got this, and there was a number of things to juggle. The language, the dialect, understanding the material. So I go in for the audition, and Daniel Sui, the casting director, he gives me some direction after the first reading. And I kind of knew what he meant. It was about being self-conscious and entertaining yourself. There's this tutor who's stuck in this job. He wants to be Byron. He knows Byron. But the best that he can do in his life right now is tutor this precocious girl. And so he's sitting there kind of like bored with the whole situation. And she asks him this question and he answers her in a way to entertain himself.
Right.
It's kind of a sophisticated thing to do, particularly when you're a young actor and you're in this audition and what you want to do is muscle your way into this part. You know, you want to show them that you can use your voice and you can use your all the things that you have just learned, you know, and which is the opposite of being casual and conscious of entertaining yourself and, you know, cynical and all of those things. And so he had given me this piece of direction and I did it again and he kind of waited and he was like, all right, thanks, man. I walked out of the building at Lincoln Center, I'll never forget, and the door closed behind me and I was like, oh, fuck, I know what he meant. Oh my God, and I didn't do it. Oh shit, and I can't do that. Actually, that's in my wheelhouse. So I called my agent, I was like.
The agent's like, uh-oh.
Dude, they hear this every time because everybody shits the bed when they do an audition because it's a terrible process. So I called him, I said, Daniel Sui gave me some direction and I totally understood it now, but I couldn't do it in the moment. Can you get me back in? And so he goes, well, okay, I hear that a lot, Billy. I'll give him a call. So he called Daniel, and Daniel said, no, Billy did fine. He's just not quite right for the part. And I was like, all right, bummer. But how awesome that I understood that piece of direction, and I knew what to do with this material. So I was just there with this material, and I would invite this friend of mine who was an actress as well, and I'd say, you want to come work on this scene with me? You know, and so we started working on this scene together just as a way of improving our skill set. You know, like we were still ambitious about that. And I was so stoked to learn something like that, you know, that
God.
Then 2 weeks went by and in the interim, I had been fired from a movie job that I had 4 days of work on. I went to Arizona or New Mexico or something, did 1 or 2 days work, flew back to New York, and then I was supposed to go back there to finish the job. And I got a call from the director and my brother gave me the message. He and I had this hilarious apartment, but he gave me the message and he said, your director called. And I was like, that's weird. We didn't really talk much while I was doing it. He's probably going to fire me. And sure enough, I got fired. And so I was having like one of those, you know, it might as well have been raining at night and some saxophone is playing on the side. I'm like, why am I acting? And I had to really consider whether or not I had the emotional wherewithal to do this profession.
But that's a bad week.
It was awful. And then I got the call that they hadn't been able to find anybody for Septimus. And would I come back in? And I'd been working on this thing, so I knew it back in front. And I walked in and I was like, I'm ready. We did it. He was like, what the fuck was that? And I go, I understood what you meant, man. Like, it just, I needed a little bit of time. I'm kind of slow. And he's like, all right, Trevor Nunn's going to be here tomorrow. You're coming in for him. Came in for Trevor Nunn, and the next day, it may have even been that afternoon, I got the part.
What a great lesson, though, that you have this window into, you know, something that you didn't know before about the part. I mean, if any actors watch this and try to take things away, that's something that I would say, oh my God, just if you love what you're doing, you love the part, like, do it anyway.
No question about it, because in fact, when... Sometimes I'll go and speak to like students, and I would say what you really need to do is learn how to manage your downtime, because that's the part of it that I have found the most difficult, is keeping a strong attitude and clear head, so that when the moment does come that you get to audition for something, you're ready. And you have to figure out your way of doing it, you know, your way of being healthy in the world, the best version of being healthy you can, so you can be prepared for those moments.
I think that what you're talking about is, like, if you're not into that process, you're probably not into acting, right?
Exactly, man.
As I would assume that any time you get a job, it's an opportunity to live someone else's life for a while. And, you know, in Almost Famous, you play a guitar player and you didn't play guitar going into it. And I read something where you said, trying to become that and filming the first few scenes of Almost Famous, that your bullshit meter was going off because it didn't feel real to you. And I just wanted to ask about that process, because in the end, what you put on screen completely worked. And I wondered what it took to, like, silence your own bullshit meter about that.
Well, what you were just describing and what Cameron was after was a sort of rare personality, a rare artist, an artist who knows they've got the shit. Like, you know, like a Michael Jordan kind of, you know.
There's an aura.
They play basketball, but what they really have is they have an enormous skill set.
They have
at their
superpowers.
Disposal. They have superpowers, exactly. Yeah. But the thing about Russell was that was supposed to be like in his bones, you know.
Yeah, it's in his gait and it's in the way he sits.
And when the guitar is an actual foreign object to you, and you see the way, because Peter Frampton was working on that, Nancy Wilson was working on that, almost everybody who was in the band was a musician. When you are around those people and you see how they do it and you know that you're forcing it, it's just loud. It's just like loud, loud, loud in your head.
And what happens to your confidence?
It's just like, that's where this... Bill Macy, who directed the movie that I
Rudderless.
Got Rudderless, that I got inspired to play guitar more and sing, there was a scene where my character just completely breaks down. And so usually my approach to that is to not try to dictate the way that that's going to happen, or just arrive at the moment and allow your body to respond in the way like that it responds as a fully prepared character. Understanding the circumstances, taking your cues off the world around you, and usually something comes up, whether it's of interest or not, is somebody else's idea later on.
Right.
But sometimes it doesn't. Like, sometimes you tighten up as Russell, even though you're supposed to be the super cool guy, because you get in your head, you get self-conscious, sometimes you get the yips as a golfer, you know, like, you know how to make a putt, but like all of a sudden you're over the ball and everything looks foreign.
Right.
So we're doing this scene in Rudderless where I'm supposed to break down, and I walk up to like a memorial, I'm waiting, I'm looking at it, I'm breathing, and this is about as much emotion as is happening. And so I say, cut, walk back, I do it again. I'm waiting. Okay, it's gonna come flooding through at any point now.
This is what I do for a living.
I have fully prepared this moment now. Why are those people looking at me? And why is Bill staring at me? Why is he pacing? All right, cut, we're gonna do it again, I go back. I'm not talking to anybody at this point, by the way. I've got like, you know, headphones, I've got some music cues for myself, I've got notes for myself, I go back to my tree.
You have a tree.
I have a tree where I've got my stuff stashed, and I'm looking over my notes, and I'm listening to my music, and setting myself up. I come back, and then Bill comes up at a certain point. He goes, hey, so I think you're going to have to fake it. And I was like, understood, boss. That's where the part of it where it doesn't come, and you just have to do your best pretend version. And it's not going to be the muse. It's not going to be something that you've exceeded your potential. But it will be workmanlike. You're going to be able to tell the story enough. So the stuff with Almost Famous, yep, it would be churning inside. You're not a rock star. You're a theater idiot who is way out of his league here. You know, like, the best you can do is to not start crying right now. So you've got that going on in your head, and you just have to go to work.
What I hear you saying is that you've had enough times where the muse does visit you and it all happens and it's real and you're lit up. And then when you're not lit up, who knows the difference other than you?
Yeah, and this happens all the time with plays where you come back at the end of it and you're like, amazing. And the director comes in and is like, what the fuck was that?
Really?
Yeah, because it's not always received in the way that it feels. And so you can't always count on that as your litmus test, you know. But there are enough times when they do line up that it's just like a spike on the chart, you know, you always just want to set yourself up for that. So most of the time, you just go do your job. You know, you understand the story, you understand your character, you get into your light, you listen to the other people around you, and then you go home and do it all again the next day, you know. And that's a really important part of acting. You know, we're talking about the inspiration, we're talking about the moments that lift you, but those are the rare, rare, rare ones.
Well, you know, it's funny because we start talking about Almost Famous and then Rudderless comes up for you. And those films are 15 years apart.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you look back at the guy that did Almost Famous and did he know those things? Or was your process more rigid back then?
Much more rigid.
I mean, when you look back at that guy and what he struggled with, do you see a large arc of growth?
You know what I see, man, and you've probably experienced this too, is that, like, life is humbling, you know? And when you're given a lot of opportunities early on and people are depending on you and there are large amounts of money invested in your fragile craft, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and it is a fragile craft.
It's fragile, man, and especially at the beginning, you know, where part of what you learn in school is that you have to develop your craft. They don't give you, like, this is what you do on day one. And on day two, you should be at this phase. And here's the text analysis. You know,
although there should be some sort of an audiobook series with that voice.
I'll certainly do it.
Because it would seem legitimate with that voice.
Well, and you know, I confess, you go $80,000 in debt, you feel like you should get that book or something to say, here's your fallback plan.
That's right.
But no, what they do in school is say, your instrument is you. So you have to learn how to utilize it best. But getting early opportunities, that interferes with that process, in fact, because not only is there a shitload riding on it, and you know that because the people are sitting around going, is that the way he's going to do it? Okay.
Right.
Are you good with that? Okay. And you're up there going, man, I knew they were whispering about something and it was not good. This is not good. I better.
If it was good, they wouldn't be whispering.
Yeah, they wouldn't be whispering. They'd be clapping. I better pretend about something.
So are you talking about you have to sort of, it's almost like living a lie because you have to put on some confidence you don't have.
You have to pretend that you know what you're doing. Oh, which lens is that? Oh, it's a 50? Awesome.
What the fuck is a 50?
Yeah.
What does it mean? It's close or not?
No, I got you, man. I got the face for a 50. That's like part of being in over your head. And then you have to do interviews with people who want to know about your philosophy.
So did you feel totally in over your head at that age?
When I look back on it, I was for sure. I was prepared in a certain way, but I wasn't prepared for the kinetic energy of those kinds of magazines, you know, where there's a lot of calls you have to take. There are a lot of new relationships you have to manage. Your old relationships become strange because they're affected by the fact that they just saw your face on a billboard. And why the fuck were you on Charlie Rose? You know, and like, that's what you think about that? And then they get affected by it because their friends think it's cool that they're friends with you. And so they don't know how to relate. So there's all sorts of different things that you have to navigate that just feels like a lot, you know.
While worrying I'm going to get fired if anyone finds out.
And what is your craft and what is it you really do and why are you special? And like, you know, like, am I ruining my future potential by only taking certain parts? Because everybody just wants me to play this romantic lead, you know. And like, I have a feeling I'm going to be much better off if I take weird ass parts and grow over the long term. But it means saying no to people who are really good at stuff. And is that a good idea? You know, like, there's a lot of people that are telling me it's not, you know.
Well, as an actor who's, like you said, not writing and not, you know, that your job is to get parts. And the only way you have control over your career is what you say yes to and what you say no to. And no way to find out what those experiences are going to be like until you experience them.
Yep.
I would think that would be a tremendous amount of anxiety.
It was, man. It was. And, you know, the truth is I kind of I just put on my game face and was like, whatever. Okay. All right. If I got picked to do this, I'm going to give it my best. If you're going to ask me a question about what I believe right now, I'm going to tell you what my answer is. And whether or not it's a load of shit, or I'm going to say it with conviction. And I'm going to make this choice. And then you start digging in your heels and showing up to photo shoots like you, having cut your hair at Supercuts and brought your own clothes. Like, and it gets super contorted. But when I look back at that period of time, I was much more taught because I felt like I had to be, you know. You get a lot of pressure from people about turning down money jobs. So then you become like a weird captain of industry. You know, like, why is anybody asking me about money? You know, like, I know how to survive by waiting tables. I know how to survive by delivering pizza. You know, that's what I did in high school and in college. I parked cars. I parked Peter Frampton's car when I was in high school at the 15th Street Fisheries. That was my claim to fame at the 15th Street Fisheries. I parked his car. 15 years later, he was changing my guitar strings while I'm playing fucking Russell Hammond. You know, it's a weird ass business.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, you're being asked questions about things that you're only learning about. So, and it happens really fast. So if you don't kind of pretend to know something, the people around you start getting a little nervous and you might be taken advantage of.
What kind of toll did that take on you?
That's a good question, man. That's a really good question. I mean, as soon as you asked me that, my whole body was like, whew. Like, thank God you asked me that. Because it does take a toll. That level of responsibility is not what you sign up for when you're learning how to pretend to be other people on stage. You know, that's not like a part of the list. And there are a lot of people that are then relying upon you to manage a situation which is completely foreign to you. So I think this is what I was en route to before, is that then you get humbled by it. You know, like this belief system and this philosophy that you've espoused about art and your place in art, you stop getting opportunities at a certain point. People start getting pissed off at you. You give some shitty performances. People ask you why you aren't more famous. People wonder if you're acting anymore. I was out here 3 or 4 years ago on general meetings, going into studios saying, hey, Billy Crudup, still acting.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
From my perspective, I just look at this amazingly varied career that bounces back and forth between Broadway and between interesting films with interesting filmmakers. I would never know that that was your experience.
Yeah, the experience I've had since that time, it's just filled me with a sense of gratitude, you know, like that I did have those experiences before, that I still have opportunities, and that I was right about myself insofar as I needed to take weird parts in lots of different genres, because my biggest strength is going to be as a character actor. The versatility is going to be the thing that allows me to sustain myself. It's not going to be because people are going to see a Billy Crudup picture. because they don't. But if I can play a character in somebody else's better version, you know, somebody else's, even if it's the lead or whatever, you know, having exercised as much as I have playing all these different kinds of parts is really beneficial to me because it's given me confidence about what I can do. And it's also like, so if the spectrum of parts is like this big, when you start out acting, you think you can do all of it. So when you actually try to do all of it, it kind of starts to narrow a little bit and creeps in, and then you go, oh shit, this is where I can sniper it. Like, this is where I have a market, you know? This is what I'm best at. This is where I get closest to that potential of getting lit up.
I think it's human nature when those opportunities present themselves when you're young to say, I'm going to go after the whole spectrum.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I wasn't really raised that way. I thought if I start taking those parts, the romantic comedy where I have to focus my work on being pithy and charming and entertaining, I will have a certain kind of career, of which we have people who are phenomenal at that.
Right.
I didn't think I had that potential to be phenomenal at that. And if I was going to get all these opportunities, I better try to exploit what I might be able to be phenomenal at, which is making people think I'm somebody else. And I had this idea that every time I'm in a movie, I want somebody to go, oh, well, that's the only part he can ever play, you know, or wait, oh, was that Crudup? Oh, you know, like those things kind of go hand in hand to me because you're so interested in the story. The storytelling is so, vivid and the characters are working together. That to me was going to be where I made my long-term career. And I knew, this is, again, I go back to school on this, they're like, take the long path, like take, and not everybody does that, you know, but for me, I think my dad was, he was a gambler and a bookie and a loan shark.
Really?
Yeah, and a con man. Charming as fuck. But that led to kind of unpredictable existence. You know, when you're supposed to get an allowance every week of $5 or whatever, and you don't get it for 6 months, and then somebody hands you $500 cash, you know, there's a lot of up and downs with that.
And yeah, I'm thinking right now, I owe my daughters 2 weeks of allowance.
Hey, don't fuck them up. They'll turn into an asshole like me. And so what I thought was, what I really want to do is take a methodical workman's approach to what is inevitably going to be a career of ups and downs.
Isn't that funny? Like to be in this crazy artistic career and want to be more stable than your father.
I know.
By choosing acting.
I know.
It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense at all. I know.
But when you describe it, it makes perfect sense. It's when you describe it, I go, okay, that period in his career where he's the next big thing and people are pushing for that and there's all that tugging on you in different ways. That was the anomaly in your career of trying to make a long...
Yeah, man. Exactly.
...artistic path.
Exactly.
And that's probably why it felt so uncomfortable.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, I'm glad we figured that out.
Yeah, man. God damn. What have I been doing in therapy? I should have just come here. Because I don't have to pay you, right?
Oh, you pay us.
Oh, okay. Well, then six of one, half a dozen of the other.
No, but I think it makes so much sense. I think a good example of that is when you play Prefontaine in Without Limits. The thing that struck me about that film, watching it again, was exactly that feeling of, as an audience member, going, yeah, this guy, this, like, I know you, and I'm thinking this is Steve Prefontaine. And there's a line in that film, and I want to say this line in reference to the prep you did for the film and understand a little bit of your process, where Donald Sutherland says, if you can find meaning in such a meaningless pursuit as long distance running, then you may find meaning in that other meaningless pursuit, which is life. And I would be very surprised if you told me you didn't run a bunch to prepare for that film, if that wasn't part of your prep and training, and if you found meaning in your own life through prepping for that film.
That's a great compliment, dude. So I feel like I should leave now. Because I don't know how it's going to get better than
that. That'd be a weird ending, though. That would be.
But hey, there's no reason not to surprise people. There was a circumstance of that was my first lead in a movie.
Oh, that was before Almost Famous.
Before Almost Famous.
I didn't know that. Okay.
And Robert Towne was directing it, and you know he had written Chinatown.
Yeah.
And Tom Cruise was producing it with Paula Wagner, and it was in over my head. You know, that kind of like I had to go through. So the prep for me was, yes, it was extremely labor intensive.
Looking back, did you go farther than you needed to?
No, absolutely not. In fact, this amazing woman, Patricia Donnelly, God, if I'm getting her name wrong, I'm going to kill myself. But it was 20 years ago, so sorry. I could barely remember what I ate for breakfast this morning.
It was
an egg white scramble.
Okay.
That's right. But the she did personal best. With Robert Towne. Not only that, she was an Olympic hurdler in 1976. So she So what she understood about the process was I didn't have to be able to run 3 miles. I didn't have to be able to run even 400 meters. What I had to do is concentrate on like 200 meter intervals because that's what we were going to shoot. And we were going to do it again and again and again. So the like, crucial part of it is to not break down. So we had a very structured system about how we went about training and what kind of muscles we were building up so that I looked more like him and how we would structure the days so that the running, so that I could run at my highest potential and then mimicking his style because he had a certain kind of style, literally ran with his chest out, you know. And between that and the way that he spoke, there was a great deal of preparation. I can remember Tim Monick, I believe, was the dialect coach on that, a very famous, excellent dialect coach. And I started doing, because there was a lot of tape on Pri liked talking about himself more than me, if you can imagine. I mean,
he was very much like a star.
Absolutely. And he was a relentless self-promoter to the point that, you know, people made up these T-shirts, Stop Pri, and you know, like that kind of arrogance was new to amateur athletics, and people thought it was, you know, what's it, like garish or whatever that word is.
Yeah.
Like, so there's a lot of tape on him, and I listened to a ton, and I talked to Tim, and I started doing it, and he goes, "You don't want to do an impression of him, do you?" And I was like, "No, I want to be him." And he was like, okay. You know, I was like, I am not fucking around on this. Like, I don't know if I have the capacity to do something as hard as, like, pretend to be somebody else who was an actual person that we have tape on.
Yeah.
That wasn't something that I had done before. And I'm not particularly great with impressions or, but I was going to give it my level best. I wasn't going to do Billy Crudup, you know, with a wig. So it was rigorous the entire time. So I think back on it now as like a one-of-a-kind experience. I mean, it was, I don't know that I've been tested to that extent. And it did teach me something about life like that, you know, like that I shouldn't take for granted the potential that I have, and if I get the opportunities, even if it's beyond my reach, I should investigate it and rip my guts out trying, you know?
Well, I tell you, that film, I feel like we could go on for hours, but one of the things that I read about you describing one of your characters gave me such, I don't know, opened my mind so much about the kind of prep one can do to know their characters. Because your characters in 1 Mile to You and 20th Century Women, they slept like rocks.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's such an interesting way to get to know a character. Because when someone tells you, oh, I slept like a baby last night, you immediately know so much about that person.
Yeah, for sure.
You know that they're not, they don't have anxiety, that they don't have a guilty conscience,
yep.
You know? And I just wonder if you could give me just a little glimpse into though the kinds of things that become very important to you for making someone like that real and three-dimensional.
Well, one of the primary tools that I utilize as an actor is questions. So I'll look at a screenplay or a certain scene. And it's not just understanding an interesting way to interpret that line. It's what aren't they saying? Why did they choose to say that as opposed to something else?
What's a good example of that? Like on a film that we would know.
Well, Spotlight. Okay. One of the things that makes that character interesting and compelling is the story that happened to him afterwards, which is true, because when I talked to Tom about doing it, I said, you know, I don't have so much interest in playing, you know, the way that he's written, he could just be like a douchey lawyer or something like that, who's, right, you know, like obfuscating the truth because it's a money grab or something, you know, and that doesn't sound like terribly true about people or so interesting. And he's like, no, so here's the story. And there was this article in 2010 on Eric McLeish, about shortly after the story came out, he began having trouble going to work, and he started having panic attacks and went and saw a psychiatrist, and sort of casually revealed over the course of a couple of weeks that he had been abused as a child.
So that's not a douchey lawyer. That's a
complicated person.
That's a guy who's got to make the compromise that in his world it's the best he can do.
Exactly. And Tom says, I'm not going to give you any lines for that. But that's what's happening underneath. And so when you look at those scenes and you see him try to politically manage the press, the interesting thing about him is all the things that I'm considering as Eric McLeish about managing doing the right thing.
And those are the questions that you ask yourself about.
That's what you do on the side, is you fill in those blanks. And you have to do it vividly. So once you start asking those questions, things like, how well do they sleep? Why would he develop this point of view about the press? What kinds of incidents? So then if you want to make it super vivid, you go back and you write a version of the time that you sent, that you leaked the names of these pedophiles to the press, and it was buried. You go through how you wrote the letter. You go through what kind of typewriter it was or what kind of pen you use. You go through how you mailed it, what you felt at that moment.
And is the goal there to try to manufacture memories as the character?
The goal there is to have a vivid, immediate experience when you're acting, so the audience interprets it as though it's happening for the first time. So we're having this conversation right now. We're inventing the things that we're saying based upon our entire history, you know, and You can sit there and get clues about us, about how we pause, what we labor over, what we find funny, what choice of words we continue to use, the dialect that we use, the way that we're sitting with each other. There's a million different ways to interpret that. And if you want to do kind of vivid character work, that's one way that you can go about it. That's not like... By the way, this isn't a sort of acting lesson. This is a specific kind of thing. Some stories don't want that. Some stories don't need complication. What they need is clarity and simplicity. You have
like Jesus' son is probably just the opposite.
Well, Jesus' son, this guy just walked through life thinking everything is a delight. You know, like the world, even though it's a shit show around him, the world is opening up before his eyes. And it's
so, you know, in that case, you have that one piece of information and
you ride that in every weird circumstance. And what the audience gets is this like invitation into Alice in Wonderland kind of scenario where you're not laboring over your own, you're not a person who's laboring over their own self-conscious. And we know people like that, you know, in the world who it's a Forrest Gump is a fictionalized version of that,
right?
You know, where
he's the extreme.
He's the extreme where they don't carry a burden on them. What they carry is a hopeful awareness. And so when you put that person in the context of like this drug-addled depravity, then it becomes
life is
interesting.
A box of heroin.
You never know what you're going to get.
But you know what I hear you saying is that as an audience member, I bet we're all assuming we're getting most of our information in the film from the lines, but maybe we're actually getting most of our information from all this other stuff you're talking about.
Well, to the point that we were talking about earlier, in the creative collaboration, particularly like Ridley Scott, we were working on Alien, right?
Yeah.
So Ridley Scott, every single frame is an art installation. The detail that goes into creating this world that you only get a passing glimpse at, it's meant to be immersive. What he's trying to do is convince you this world exists.
You know, it's funny you say that, because when I watched it, I was exhausted for the set designer.
Oh.
Because it was like, how did they build all this?
I'm telling you, you know what they did? Is they built it.
That's amazing.
Exactly. They designed it, they built it, and these are artisans working at the top of their craft. So you walk onto these sets, and you cannot believe the ingenuity. And also, the disgusting mind of Ridley Scott, you know, like he loves this shit. And it's so vivid for him, and he's such a brilliant creative mind that and he's also like thrilled about showing you all of it because he loves what he does, you know. And so when you see the movie, it's so dark and overwhelming, but when you're actually doing it, you're so excited that this genius master craftsman has invited you into his lab and you get to see him mixing his potions, you know? So a person like that, they're constructing an entire world for you. And the collaboration there is just to make sure that you are a part of that
building. The performance fits the world.
That's right.
It's funny you say that, and I'm reminded of something actually that Matt Damon said, which is job number one of an actor is to know what movie you're in.
Exactly, man. That's exactly.
And it seems obvious, but it is not obvious.
It's not obvious at all.
And like you describing your process on Spotlight being so different from the process on Jesus' Son, that's knowing what movie you're in. But sitting here talking with you about this, first off, I think I've gotten to like six of the things I wanted to talk about out of the four-hour conversation I imagined in my head. But when you talk about the way you handled your audition on Arcadia, the way you felt lit up on stage, the way you had to do some serious soul-searching for the Russell Hammond situation when you didn't feel like that guy, when you had to learn to fake it, what you're describing is that you're in this profession that there are as many permutations of it as there are jobs.
Right.
And so if you're not present and willing to be, you know, thrown around in the waves of whatever's going on, then you're not really living the actor's life.
100%, man. And that and it goes back to what I was saying before, which is I've seen and know a million actors who don't get to ride that wave, you know, who are really trying to find any 3-month job so that they can get their health insurance for the, and they don't, I mean, you will do anything, and the potential of it lighting you up is like even more minuscule. There's almost no potential in, you know, some projects. So it has been a pretty relentless effort on my part to go for exactly what you're describing. And I'm sure there's other ways to describe it that are not nearly as kind. You know, it's like, was I thinking it was gonna be my heroic effort to be an actor every day? Probably not. But mostly my thing is, are you trying to tell a kick-ass story? Because I don't care if we fail along the way. I'm good with that, dude. I just wanna come in and be a part of your version of being a badass. And if I think I can help in that in some way, I'm in, you know. Or if you think I can help in a way that I don't yet know, I'm in, you know. And that's a remarkable way to go about a life and a profession.
I mean, I think that the films you've made, the roles you've chosen to play, like I said, just going back over your work, watching 20th Century Woman, watching Jackie, watching Rudderless, and Jesus' Son, which is just a phenomenal work, and I'm excited to see what you do next, and I'm in awe of your talent, so you shouldn't be as hard on yourself.
I appreciate that. Listen, I had two brothers growing up. If you don't keep yourself in check, somebody else will.
Well, you're doing a good job of keeping yourself in check, but I will sing your praises And I'm a big fan, so thanks for coming and doing this.
Sam, it is my privilege to sit around and talk to you about this because you're doing the stuff that I'm interested in, too.
Well, thank you. Let's go have a sandwich.
Let's do it.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. And if you want to scare the pants off yourself, go see Billy Crudup in Alien Covenant. And then go home, type Billy Crudup into whatever streaming device you use, and enjoy hours of amazing performances. I would recommend Stage Beauty, Jesus Son, Rudderless, or almost anything else he's been in. And when you're done with that, go visit offcamera.com. If you haven't checked out our site, or if you haven't been there lately, we have a lot of exciting things in store for you. As you know, Off Camera is also a television show, and now, with a monthly subscription, you can watch any Off Camera episode you want in the comfort and privacy of your own home in glorious black and white whenever you want to do it. Just go there and hit the subscribe button, and you can be deep diving into the archives of Off Camera. Then, go to the store, because we have an exclusive Off Camera magazine, and it's a great way to support the show. You can order a 12-issue subscription or buy magazines a la carte and have the unique experience of off-camera delivered right to your door in magazine form. And just in this week, we've gotten signed issues of motocross legend Ricky Carmichael and Foo Fighters guitarist Chris Shiflett, who have each signed a limited number of magazines. So get those while they last and check out the whole site. And if you have any comments or questions or ideas, send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. On social media, I am Sam Jones Pictures at Instagram, and I am Sam Jones on Twitter, and we are Off Camera Show on both Twitter and Instagram. So that's a lot of ways to get a hold of us. And please, if you're enjoying Off Camera, don't keep it to yourself. Tell your friends about the show. Tweet about us, Instagram us, Facebook us, or just pick up the phone and tell your friends all about Off Camera. You know, this show is a pretty grassroots effort, so please spread the word, and hopefully we can keep doing this show for a long time into the future. I want to thank everyone that helps me out on the show. We have Nathan Shields, Crawford Shippey, Laura Kemper, Michaela Galvin, Amy Jones, Cara Johnson, Matt Davidson, and Justin Kennedy. All these folks work really hard to bring you the show, and we couldn't do it without all of their hard work. And finally, make sure to join me next time when I sit down with writer, actor, and show creator Danny McBride.
It really is a matter of, like, why is the reason you're doing it? And is it to have everyone universally at one point turn to you and be like, yes, good work, you've done it, you know? Or, you know, what is the reason? And I really think, for me, the definition of success is that we're creating stuff with guys I knew since I was 18 years old, and everyone's getting better at what they do and trying different things, and that just kind of feels like that's enough.
Danny is known for playing characters of his own creation who are foul-mouthed, hot-tempered, self-centered, and not prone to self-examination. It's made him an in-demand star in blockbusters like Tropic Thunder and Alien Covenant. But you'll see his most original work in his own projects, darkly comic shows like Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals. Funny thing is, he never planned to be an actor. You'll hear about his unlikely journey from film school in North Carolina all the way to Hollywood, and The Foot Fist Way, the movie that not only started it all, but serves as his creative rallying cry to this day. You'll also hear about the other film that started it all, if I can bring myself to talk about it. See you next time, Off Camera.